in de signal gevallen.
Ja, die was binnengedrongen in de koorgroep zelfs. Ja.
De koorgroep.
Dat is echt een hele goeie volgens mij.
Ja.
Ja. En het is ook een damesgestalte volgens mij. Dus, is altijd goed.
Maar komt die in de Jitsi of komt ze in de studio?
Ze komt naar de studio gewoon gezellig.
Ja. Geweldig.
Dat is weer morgen leuk.
Ja, dat wordt een
12 uur.
Gezellige drukte om 12
live.
Uur in de Patapoef Studio, Studio 1 of 2. Wat is het eigenlijk?
Heb je al beschreven studio wat we hier 11? Allemaal te zien hebben? Want dat zien
nee,
de
nog niet.
Niet.
Stop Trumpgas.
Toxic Energy.
Hello technical.
Ja, stop Trumpgas.
Hoe doe je dat?
Je billen heel hard samenknijpen.
Ja, dat dacht ik ook aan zoiets. Trump
ja,
stinkt.
Dat doet me ook denken. Ik zie stop Trump. Als je voor stop Trump bent, dan kun je ook naar het Museumplein komen. Vrijdag, 1 mei. Dan is daar voorafgaand aan de grote 1 mei demonstratie is er een stop Trump bijeenkomst. Dat is elke eerste vrijdag van de maand.
Blijf jij hier?
Ja, ik zit aan een draadje. Dus ik ga niet weg hier. Ja, tot zo. Ja, dat is collega Jo van Radio Potatoe. Is er om 12 uur het wekelijkse praatprogramma PSN. De P van Potapoe. En de SDM van Serieus Gemeente. Maar vanavond hebben we dus een aantal activisten van MICE uit Minneapolis. En Autumn is ook al gesignaleerd. Van Indivisible Nederland. Gaan we misschien ook nog tegenkomen later. Maar eerst gaan we luisteren naar de Minneapolitaanse ijsmensen.
Thank you.
Ja, ik zou het nog een paar keer geven. Ja, nee, maar dat is...
Het is tegen de tafel.
Hello everyone, welcome. Please take a seat, settle down so we can get started. Hi everyone, so good to see so many of your faces here. Some familiar faces, some unfamiliar faces. You might know me, my name is Renske, I'm the director of Fossielvrij, and I'll be hosting tonight's evening. Thank you for mild support, I appreciate it. Tonight we're celebrating No King's Day after yesterday's King's Day. After all the trash in the streets, we're gonna create some beauty here on the stage. And for that, we have three amazing organizers who are gonna tell us about resisting. What does it mean? What can we do here? And how can we still create space to resist while so much around us is crumbling down? Some practicalities. Please put your phone on silent. Thank you so much for this practical response. We have a photo policy, which is already communicated to you at the door. But just one more time, if you don't want to be on any photos in a recognizable way, then there's some blue tape that you can put on your shirt, and then we'll make sure that none of those pictures will ever see the light of day. If you have some space, please scoot over. I think there's some space over here, so if people still come in, there's some chairs that you can use over here, and we have some pillows at the front if you would like to sit over there. Then please keep the sides of the room free, so that in case of an emergency, we can all leave orderly and safely. And something that I think is also important to mention is we are doing this event free of cost because we want to make it accessible to as many people as possible. But of course, there are costs tied to this event. For Fossielvrij, for the food that we're giving, the organizers, the people working on this event, but also for us when we want to organize more and more of these events and we want to make them as accessible as possible. So you might have already seen the QR code that was at the front. And I would love to remind you that you can use that QR code to donate to Fossielvrij so we can host more events like this. All right, so to get started, you might know Fossielvrij, I hope you do. We're a climate justice organization, and one of our biggest wins has been getting ABB to divest from the fossil fuel industry. And I didn't work at Fossielvrij then, but I remember it being such an inspirational moment for me as a climate activist, because I worked really hard, and it seemed like everything was going downhill, and then all of a sudden there was this win out of the blue. But it wasn't out of the blue. It was because so many people came together over and over again, and they decided that there was something worth fighting for. And I think that that's a really inspiring message, and that's why I'm super happy that I now get to kind of claim this win also as my own. At Fossielvrij, we focus on diverging financial streams away from bad things and onto the good. be focused on stopping climate obstruction, misinformation, false solutions, and we focus on democracy. So all the energy that we're using, who's it for and who's it from? But also, what are the rights of the people protesting for this energy, for clean energy, for a clean future? What are their rights? So these are the things that we're focusing on, and also some of the topics that we're going to talk about today. And we are organizing this event because we're going to be talking about divestment, and as you hear, this is a very core part of our theory of change, but also because we feel that as a climate movement, we really need to build this resilient group of people, of people that can stand together, of people that can build solidarity, also for topics that might not be directly in the core business. So we really want to think about who are we protecting, who are we using all of the people that we have in the climate movement, who are we directing that energy towards, and how can we help each other and build solidarity. And that's also why we are so honored that we have three amazing guests who can tell us more about this, and that so many of you are excited to show up. One more thing before we get into the nitty-gritty of the night. There are two events coming up. And since I have all of you here and you're still listening so attentively, I think it's important to mention it. On the 5th of May in Utrecht on the Domplein, there's an anti-fascist demo related to Bevrijdingsdag. Since we're celebrating then that we got rid of fascism, at least for a while, we thought it would be important to also have this demonstration where we stand together in solidarity with the anti-fascist movement. And on the 9th of May, Defense Netherlands, so the far-right group, let's call it that, will be protesting at Ter Apel. They are inspired by all the vile things that have been said and done around the refugee centers. And they are coming there on the 9th of May, and there's also a counter-protest by anti-fascists on the 9th of May. So if you feel like this is important, and if you feel like your Saturday could be spent in a very useful way, I would really like to inspire you to go there. All right, now let's get started. I would like to ask to the stage Raphael, Sagira, and Jeanette. Thank you guys so much for being here. We're going to do this as follows. We're first going to introduce the organizers one by one. So you get to know them a little bit, get to know a little bit about their insights, and then we'll have a communal discussion and talk a little bit deeper about some of the topics that I just talked about. So let's start with you, Raphael. So Raphael is a Lakota Barico rapper, singer, songwriter from Minneapolis, and uses their music as a form of resistance. He's part of the Indigenous Protectors Movement and the Minneapolis Ice Watch. And you're also involved in communal aid, protesting, and community patrolling. And you were involved with the struggle at Standing Rock and the anti-pipeline movement Stop Line 3. So you do lots of groundwork, and I thought maybe just one thing to also give us some more information. Could you tell me something about community patrolling and communal aid? What is it practically?
Yeah, so in the context of Operation Metro Surge, there were community patrols. I was also engaged in community patrolling, and it was it exists to as a counter-surveillance measure to ICE and to keep an eye on their movement, to essentially prevent an ICE raid from happening, a kidnapping from happening, because they're kidnapping people and detaining people, essentially anybody who is not white in our communities is a target. And so there's a coordinated effort through legal observers who have gotten lots of training, over 30,000 residents across the Twin Cities Metro received legal observer training to have the skills to know how to respond when ICE is in an area, to essentially keep our immigrant relatives especially safe, because they are the main ones who are a target of ICE violence.
All right, thank you. And you already talked a little bit about keeping safe. So something that we talk a lot about in the Netherlands is that people protesting on the ground, we see that their rights are being quite quickly infringed upon in the under the guise of public order, under the guise of safety, vehicles that need to be safe. And we see that because of that, the space to protest becomes smaller and smaller, the space to resist. And I was wondering, especially with ICE on the streets, I think this is, I think that there's an even bigger scale that this is happening where you're from. And I was wondering, where do you make and find the space to resist? What measures do you take to stay safe? So you already talked about community patrolling. Are there other, are there other ways that you make space?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, ICE, you know, being in our communities and being under a fascist occupation, especially during the height of Operation Metro Surge, it meant not taking these safety measures, such as not traveling or being alone as much as you can. You know, at some point you will have to be, but if you can minimize that as much as you can, having close affinity groups with you, if you are going out to protest, having an exit strategy, having, you know, your lawyers written down on your arms and things like that, so that if you do happen to get arrested in an action, you'll have some legal support to, you know, help get you out, jail support and whatnot. And, I mean, it's just being super communicative with your affinity groups and getting to know your neighbors, especially. That was huge. It was always best to be in groups outside, and that's why we had so many different community functions. That's why legal observers were posted up on every block, because being outside with each other was our biggest protection. That's why it's so important to get to know your neighbors, make new friends, make new comrades, because if you're caught alone, oftentimes it's easier for ICE to pick someone off when they're moving alone. And so just being a part of bigger groups was a big protection. In terms of keeping yourself safe at, like, a protest, I mean, getting frontline direct action training is always good. Knowing and doing risk assessment and knowing, like, okay, maybe I don't have my personal protective gear on me. Maybe it's a smart idea to play the back line instead of the front line. Or if I am playing the front line and I'm up front with the police, having the proper gear on is essential, because I've seen people who really want to activate and they are at the protest and they do go up to the front, and I've seen people lose an eye, I've seen people get hurt really bad. And so those safety measures as far as personal protective gear are really important, and especially getting that training too.
Thank you so much. All right, I'll move on to Sagira. So, Sagira, you're a poet, a performer, an artist, a performance artist from Minneapolis, and you have your debut coming out in 2027 called Spirit, an African-American Muslim Lyric. You use art to make space for recognition, healing, and resistance, but you're also an organizer, Labor for Palestine, and an active member at the Green Party, and you've been involved in many protests. So the Black Lives Matter protests following the death of, or the murder of George Floyd, the Palestinian Solidarity and ICE resistance. Like I just mentioned, you are involved in so many different protests, and we already talked a little bit about organizing on so many different teams. And I was wondering, how do you organize such a diverse group of people, and also what are opportunities that we can learn from, but also what might be pitfalls that we should look out for?
Yeah, so that's, thank you for that question. I am a part of a lot of groups. I'm also a part of a coalition of faith leaders called Faith of Minnesota, but it's a part of a larger network. And I'm a part of our Muslim coalition. And I bring that up because we were involved with some of the community organizing broadly. And we also were behind preparing people for the general strike that we had in January, as well as in collaboration, coalition with labor unions, small businesses, student organizations, all kinds of different affinity groups and coalitions, grassroots and otherwise. When we talk about building a broad coalition, one of the opportunities is diversity of tactics and diversity of skill and being able to mobilize people quickly. A lot of times we get in habits when we're like with small groups, like, I don't know, even with project management, some people are like, I'm gonna do all the things. It's toxic, it's not possible. But you have a comrade or someone with an expertise in like communications, or you know an artist who can do like zines that can educate the general public in multiple languages, or you know someone in a different coalition or community who can bring all their retired church buddies to come and do a sit-in at a targeted business to demand that they do X, Y, and Z. You can bring in student organizers who maybe have a more flexible schedule than someone with children to do mass like flyering and door knocking in small immigrant communities to let them know that, hey, by the way, here are some whistles, here's some information, and also we're your neighbors, we wanna be in community with you, empower you, be an accomplice with you. So my point is, the benefit of building a broad coalition is that no one individual organization or individual can do it all. The more that you have a diversity of folks with different skill sets working collaboratively and together in a broad coalition, the more opportunities that you have to strengthen your network and to provide this really dynamic ability to resist and respond rapidly and in a way to pull in more people. So a lot of times in organizing, we talk about moving with a coalition of the willing. Especially in crisis situations, you have to respond fast. And when we were doing the general strike, I was on a steering committee for organizing the general strike as a member of Minnesota Labor for Palestine, which is a grassroots coalition of union and non-union workers who are building that working class solidarity with Palestine. The steering committee, we had like a week to plan a strike that got participation across, like millions of people participating across the state, 100,000 people marching in negative degree weather. We're getting people shutting down business. We're doing direct actions, series of direct actions targeting airlines, stores that were collaborating with ICE, et cetera, et cetera. And we had a short amount of time, 70 people on the steering committee representing their particular groups, so 70 different organizations or coalitions, and we're on a Zoom. You know when you have a Zoom with like five people, it's chaotic. Could you imagine a Zoom with 70 different organizations with different entry points and methodologies? It can be chaotic, right? So there's always going to be divisions. Maybe there, even within an affinity group or identity group, for example, there was a conflict with like Somali Americans and African Americans, and like how do you navigate those tensions but still keep going because we have a really big existential threat. So divisions is a reality, but it is also that diversity of information, the creativity that comes with bringing in a lot of people with different entry points, different expertise, that is our strength. And so we were able to do a mass mobilization because we had so many people involved in the group that had the sound system, the group that could get all of the people to sign pledges to participate. That's the advantage. But the complications that you think about surrounding any kind of group organizing, that's the reality times 10 when you mobilize a group of people towards a direct action. I don't know if I answered the question completely.
I think you did. I think we'll talk a little bit more in a bit about
tensions that also exist in the Netherlands and in the progressive movement there. I want to move on to Jeanette. So Jeanette, you're a community organizer at Minneapolis Federation of Educators. You've been monitoring ICE crimes, ICE violence, and you support workers and their families in Minnesota. And you're part of, I have a whole list here, but I don't even know if it's complete. The Union OPU Local 12, the Democratic Socialists, the Socialist Collective, the Tempest, and the Remember 1934 Collective, which is for workers' rights and equity. And I wanted to ask you about bravery and strategy. I think lots of people here know the Democratic Socialists with Zahra Mamdani as a shining example. And from there on, I think we know AOC, those are names that are pretty memorable in the Netherlands. And I think the Minnesota Union also, just like the Democratic Socialists, have really shown that bravery is a strategic choice. But what we've seen as, I think, fossilvrij, but also as activists, is that often when we talk to other organizers or other organizations or political parties, is that they see bravery not so much as a strategic choice. They see outspoken anti-fascist or leftist ideals, or ideals that are very strongly in solidarity with, for example, migrant communities, they see it as not a strategic choice. And I really would love to hear your reflection on that, and also I think that the groups that you've been a part of have really shown that it is a strategic choice, and how have you convinced people in the past to move in this direction?
Yes, so I've been attacked by the far right at different moments of my life. When I was a rank and file teacher in a suburb outside of Washington, D.C. in Virginia, I was attacked by the far right during the COVID-19 pandemic, during the Black Lives Matter uprising that happened when George Floyd was murdered. And I also have been attacked about my views for Palestine. And so I'm a Muslim woman. I'm a socialist, a revolutionary socialist. I'm part of the Fourth International. And yeah, so I've been fired from jobs for being pro-Palestine. I've almost been fired for being pro-Palestine. So I think I'm going to be honest, like, I have anxiety and I have depression, so I'm always on the precipice of, like, freaking out about things, but I decide that bravery and courage is a choice, because, like, being silent and complicit is way worse. And I'm also a pretty emotional person, and I have, like, a lot of anger. And I care about making the world a better place. So I'm stubborn. So I'm an open book, and I speak my mind. So recently, when after October 7th happened, 2023. Which I hope everyone knows in the room, that was not the start of the genocide. That was the worsening and the acceleration of it. One of the organizations I'm a part of, the Twin Cities Democratic Socialists of America, wrote a statement being very, 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 very explicit about how we felt about the genocide. And we got attacked by Mayor Fry and Governor Tim Walz, and some of you might know who that is because he was vice presidential candidate in the Democratic Party next to Kamala Harris, who's running for president. And I was one of the people who, like, helped write and edit the statement. And there were people, comrades, in DSA, because we're a big tent socialist organization. We have anarchists, Trotskyists, Maoists, Stalinists, you name it, social Democrats. So there, and there are people I would say they're like, might not call themselves Zionist, but they were like doing Zionist apologia, which is still Zionism to me. And this was before DSA passed the anti-Zionist resolution at our national convention. And so there were technically, I think, Zionists in DSA. DSA was founded by Zionists, unfortunately, and Zionism was very prevalent in socialist movements around the world. So there's a lot of conflict in Twin Cities DSA, and I got really mad at people. And like I mentioned, I'm Muslim. My mother's Moroccan. I'm half Moroccan. I have a Palestinian family. So it's a deeply personal issue for me. And I found sometimes I had to take breaks from certain organizing spaces because I was angry, and I was just like, okay, I'm gonna step back and let other comrades deal with this. But I remember a few weeks later, a comrade in DSA, a rank and file member, was like, hey, I want to talk about the statement that we passed. Like, I think it went too far, but I think we need to bring a statement to the union, MFE. And I was like, I'm staff, we can't really, like, talk about this, but, you know, there is going to be backlash. So you need to be prepared for that. And it's probably going to be worse than the backlash that we dealt with in DSA. And there was. I mean, there was a lot of backlash from membership, from the Zionists. And then later on, we had a series of events with community members for Palestinian educating our membership, where I don't want to get into too many details, but leadership of the union was being attacked so violently. These are black women who are leaders of the union. Zionists were sending them thousands and thousands of emails using the N-word, like racial epithets, because Zionists are racist and are fascists. It should not be a shocker that they're also anti-black. And unfortunately, there was some capitulation that occurred, and it was really terrible, and I was very upset. And I thought about quitting my job because I was so mad. But I had a comrade in Muslims for Just Futures, who used to work for Unite here, which is a restaurant union and hotel union. And she's like, don't quit. We need people like you in these positions. And so, like, I remember I was, like, crying, like, a lot for months because I was so mad about so many things because I love my job, but I didn't like the conflict that was occurring. And I stuck it out, and I helped the rank-and-file members. And I was struggling with our union leadership and other staffers and other people in the labor movement around the issue. And eventually, in coalition, Sagira knows this story because she's very much part of this with her union, MAPE. We got 90% of our public pensions divested from Israeli war bonds, which is a huge deal. In Minnesota, I should say, in Minnesota, not around the United States. And I helped members go to their state union, Education Minnesota, 80,000 members, have a broad statement of, we are going to divest our pensions from weapons of war and ecological destruction. So the Zionists couldn't say a damn word. We were strategic. And also, so we wouldn't have to keep going back about every single issue. And I want to mention that, I know we're going to talk more about fossil fuels later, having your pensions invested in weapons of war and ecological destruction is unstable. These are unstable investments, and they're not good. So we should not be investing in these things. We can invest in our communities instead, and we can invest in green technology, and you name it. This is something we can just discuss more later. So we don't... I also want to mention, too, like, teachers are really, like, fortunate to have a good pension. It's one of the best things about the job, and a very difficult job that's getting worse and worse and worse because of the privatization of public education. But we have members who are like, I'd rather not have a pension if it's dripping in blood. I am of the mindset of, I'm proud to be a union member, and a union organizer, and I think pension is very important. This is, I mean, there was a time in the United States people were dying on the shop floor because they didn't retire. So I am very pro-pension, and I'm not going to shy away from that. But I am also of the mindset, I don't want my pension dripping in blood either. So we have retirees who are so mad at active members that they're even pushing for divestment. So there's a struggle between the retired members and the actives, and it's an ongoing issue. So it's really important to know that, like, I spoke at the Minneapolis Regional Labor Federation about this tour, trying to get political support. A woman who the room is named after, she called me touched while I was speaking. That means two things. It means you're either mentally retarded, I'm not using it in like the bad way, I'm just saying that's literally what it means, or you're crazy. So this woman, who used to be president of this union I worked for decades before, was calling me crazy or, you know, because I care about divestment. Because children in Palestine, men and women, innocent people who've been under occupation for 76 years, I'm crazy? So, yeah, there's violence, but I'm not going to shut up. I'm going to keep on talking whether you like it or not. So, I'm on WikiLeaks. I don't know, I can't remember if I'm on Canary Mission. I know somehow it got leaked that I was helping our members, and I my Twitter and all these things I was saying and retweeting. So yeah, and we might face repression in the United States after this tour, who knows? But we're here right now, and we have no choice to fight, but for fight for our community. They're trying to pass the Mamdani Act. They're trying to come after people like us. But also, they've been coming after people like us for a long time. So whether you're indigenous, you're black, and you're African descendant of slavery, if you're Muslim, if you're Arab, if you're a migrant, so you have no choice. So if you have privilege, this is a call of action. People in the room have privilege, white people in particular, and elders. Stand up, be an accomplice, help us. Use your power and your privilege to do the right thing. Because it's not enough to win the war, the moral war. We need you to give us power.
Thank you so much. And let's talk a little bit more about divestment and what we can do here. I think this was really powerful what you said, and I think that it also shows like how much of a difference there is, I think, between the abstract threats that that we face when we talk about divestment, and also how kind of in Dutch we say ver van je bed, far from your own bed, so it might be, and then we think that divestment doesn't really have these really concrete consequences, and. Well, as Fossilvrij, we've been working with divestment since we started. And you guys already talked a little bit about that there's these really concrete effects that follow from investing or divesting. Something that we are really bothered by as well is the rise of big tech and AI and how kind of away from any type of governance it is, where we feel like there's no accountability, and there's just deals being made over and over again. I think today, between Google and the Pentagon, of course, and it feels like there's a bunch of billionaires that just choose whatever our future is going to be. But they have to make these deals with public organizations, so with governments, but also with pension funds, but also with banks. And so, for example, we know that there's big money coming from the ING bank going to Palantir. We also know that ABP, a huge pension fund, and PFZW, another huge pension fund in the Netherlands, both divested from Palantir this year, which is really amazing news. But often for us, it kind of appears as this idea of like, oh, okay, now that I don't invest in this bad company, whatever it is that they're doing somewhere. But I would love to know, why does this investment matter? So what is Palantir doing in the US? How is it affecting you? How is mass surveillance affecting you? Maybe you would like to start, and then whenever you want to jump in on this divestment and how it affects you, I would love to know.
Yeah. Sure. So Palantir is one of the greatest threats to our democracy and to our safety right now. And a lot of people don't know what they're doing and how their technology is killing people and how it's violating our privacy. Palantir is a company, is a US-based corporation that operates internationally. And this corporation is being funded by European financial institutions, and we have just got done doing a full divestment run in Switzerland because Swiss banks like UBS and the Swiss National Bank are invested in Palantir and other ICE contractors as well, and BNP in France, and now I'm learning that ING is invested in Palantir, which is terribly disturbing. The way it impacts us in Minneapolis directly, Palantir was a central surveillance apparatus used on the citizens of the Twin Cities area during Operation Metro Surge. They were using facial recognition technology to scan faces of anyone. You could be just a random person not suspected of a crime, and they could be taking your photo, and that photo will be used and compared against thousands of driver's licenses and social media accounts and what have you to then build a profile on you with your legal name, your address, your business address, the people that you are acquainted with, and past engagement with any protest movements. They were also using stingray technology, which essentially pretends to be a cell phone tower and within a 2-mile radius can pull data from anyone's phone and build a profile on you. Palantir wants to build a profile on every single American citizen. Why is this disturbing? Well, first of all, it's an invasion of our privacy, and second of all, they're essentially doing searches without a warrant. And this is the same technology that they're using to kill Palestinians in Gaza. They're using AI kill technology. They use this same surveillance technology on the people in France during the Olympics, right? And so, even though this is an American company and they are using this technology on us and it impacts us, this is a global issue, and that's why it's incredibly important for us to build solidarity together, link with each other, talk about how we can build strategy and direct action, and fight this fascist initiative. I mean, this technology is terrible, and you know the people don't deserve that. And we're here to take a stand, and especially to call out the banks to divest. And if they don't divest, you know, so many of these banks, like Swiss National Bank, for example, they claim that they value and they uphold and respect human rights. Yet they are invested in ICE contractors that are violating our human rights. It's a total hypocrisy. And so if they don't divest, it's up to us to tear down their social license and to tear their reputation apart and put them on blast and let the world know that they are violating our human rights, and they are to be held accountable.
One thing that I would love to add also is that it's not just banks. So investigative journalists from Follow the Money have also figured out that they found out that the Dutch government also had deals with Palantir. This is after Peter Thiel, their founder, said that he doesn't mind if Palantir kills innocents or if it kills at all. And when asked about these deals, the Dutch ministry actually didn't give the full information on this, so we still don't know how deep this deal goes, also between our Dutch government and Palantir. So we really see it's not just banks, it's really our public institutions that are all so tied up into these crimes.
Just to add to that, that's a good point. In terms of Palantir's impact with our public institutions, recently it was exposed that Palantir was collaborating with the Internal Revenue Services in the United States, which is, does our taxes and documents, our funding in the United States, and utilizing the data that they collected there to find opportunities to essentially accuse people of fraud. So they're helping the government to accuse people for fraud to denaturalize people who have citizenship. Palantir is also involved in the United States. They recently got a contract to be in control of our food with the USDA. This is recent, it's really terrifying. So they're gonna be able to have control over the data over our food. So this is really terrifying that a company that published a manifesto that's truly horrific is kind of infiltrating many different parts of public life in the United States. Personally, with ICE, and as someone with trauma with ICE, I was kidnapped by ICE, although I'm a citizen, and was inside of the Whipple detention facility for 7 hours. And I saw, it was also like my comrades on the front lines of like rapid response, patrolling, and I saw how ICE agents utilize the surveillance technology firsthand to intimidate and to harass and to try to violate the human rights of our community members. And we're able to, for example, like they used to, when rapid responders or people who were responding to ICE would follow ICE agents in their cars, sometimes the ICE officers would take the person to their home. They do intimate details about people because they were scanning them. They were able to say like terrifying things to people because they had sensitive information on them, because they were utilizing technology that could find those things to intimidate people. When I was inside of the Whipple facility, the agents who were harassing me and intimidating me, they knew really intimate details about my life, and I'm suspecting, I don't have proof of this, just because they were able to pull up from a database. And then, you know, we could go on and on about the different ways that Palantir is just an immoral company that is really trying to implement this techno-fascist world where technology and businesses and corporations have more rights than people. It's very terrifying. They're directly responsible for the countless murder and genocide of so many people and facilitating that. And so we have to be clear about resisting that, about prioritizing our human rights and asserting those rights and demanding that our institutions divest. We don't need these fascist technology companies destroying our communities. I could talk about data centers and how much they're destroying Black communities, Indigenous communities in the United States. It's an existential threat for all of us, and so many communities that are resisting ICE, resisting the police, resisting all these things, are also resisting the ecological harms that these data centers are having on our communities. It's exhausting, it's frustrating, and so we need to be very clear. Divestment now, divestment right away, and organize. Do not let these techno-fascist corporations or anyone who collaborates with them go off without having resistance. You have to publicly assert our rights and push back.
Thank you. Yeah, I think it's interesting that you mentioned data centers, because very close to Amsterdam, Microsoft is now starting to build a data center, and it's exactly how you mentioned it. We really see that these big corporations have so much more rights than we do. So the decision made to create a data center that takes up so much of our energy, our land, even though we're in a housing crisis, our electricity, even though we're in an electricity crisis, we see that decision is made quite quickly because there's so much money involved. But for the people to fight it, it's such, like, there's such a long path. Often we're informed way too late, then these deals have already been made. And exactly as you mentioned, also between the Dutch government and Palantir, we know that the non-disclosure agreements are so, so tight that even governments are scared to be transparent to their people, which is really awful. I want to move on to the next bit, if that's okay. Because something that we do see when we look at the data centers is that we've talked to quite a few groups, and there's so much interest in protesting something like this, because we see that it affects so many of us. So it affects the people working for affordable housing, it affects us when we're talking about democracy and energy. It affects a lot of people living in Amsterdam who don't want to live next to a polluting center, but it also affects the Palestinian movement, because we know what Microsoft has done with its technology, the deals that they have been making with the IDF, and we see that there are so many of these groups coming together. And I think that this creates a great opportunity for us, but I think it also highlights something that at least I'm struggling with a lot, and that's the fact that there's so much happening all at once, and I think all of you understand this since you're all in 50 different organizations and you're doing 100 different things, and I think there's some tension where we push for divestment on one hand, and then there's investment in three other, maybe even worse things, and we focus on climate, but then we can't close our eyes to what's happening to migrant communities, to the trans community in the Netherlands, to Palestine. And maybe I want to start with you, Jeanette. Like, how do you navigate this tension? And did you at some point choose to maybe shift strategies? Like, how do you choose when so much is happening all at once, but you're also only one person, or maybe for the organizations that you're active for? How do you navigate this?
It's all connected. So Palantir, they're coming after civil liberties, they're committing atrocities through genocide, they're creating the climate catastrophe, or they're accelerating it. And they're not, obviously, they're not the only corporation. So I think, like, that's the goal of fascism, is to make us afraid and fearful and also tire us out. But also, I'll just use an example of the union I work for, which has 4,000 members. In the last 6 years, and I've only worked there for 3 or 4 years, new active layers of the union has cropped up through various fights. I know members who were involved in Standing Rock who were active in our union, and they started an eco justice committee. The Black Lives Matter movement with the George Floyd uprising was so essential, like literally one of the leaders of the union, who's the teacher chapter president, Marsha Howard, she lives like steps away from where George Floyd was murdered. Her own student took footage of him being murdered. Like, her involvement in that movement and her union backing her and fighting back in community against police brutality and anti-blackness galvanized the membership. 2 years later, they went on a strike. They hadn't gone on strike in 52 years. And then a year later, October 7th, more and more members got involved in the union because of Palestine. And then more and more members got involved in the union because of the Deportation Defense Committee. So it's like hundreds of members throughout the years have gotten more and more involved in their union and found a political home. Something Raphael and Sagira said earlier reminded me of something we did at MFE that I totally forgot about, because so many things happened during this time. It's just hard to overstate. We had first aid responder trainings, direct action, direct care trainings through our national union, the American Federation of Teachers. I didn't even know one of our national unions did this. But these amazing comrades flew to Minnesota to give these trainings to teach our members about how to be frontliners and gave them red backpacks. We were calling them medics, but we got some backlash internally in the community. Like, don't call that because it's not enough time for the training to be called that. And I had a member come up to me and say, I didn't think it was possible to love my union even more than I ever did. And I was like, wow. And you know, and the idea of this happened, I think it was the day, I can't remember if it happened when Renee Nicole Good was murdered or Alex Pretty was murdered, because all this happened like less than a mile away from George Floyd Square. A member of our union who's a nurse, who her husband works for UFCW, which is the United Food and Commercial Workers Union. He's friends with a guy who works for the American Federation of Teachers, and he's like, hey, you know that we can get you red medical bags and teach you how to be frontliners. I was just like, wow. So it's like we literally, just in one organization, obviously there are so many organizations, like Sagira said, 70-plus organizations were like involved in this, but just within one organization, one political home, our members were doing mutual aid. They were frontliners. They were pushing for divestment. I mean, I can't even emphasize. So it's like, what am I getting into? What am I saying? Why am I saying all this? Yeah, I'm a staffer, I work for the union, but I, like Sagira is saying, I'm just one person. I'm the organizer. I'm paid full-time to work for the union. But I don't do everything. We're an organizing model. We're a class struggle social justice organizing union. The membership understands that this is their union. We say this, you need to say this is my union. This is our union, not the union. Don't third party the union. So I, like, at the end of January, this is deeply personal, I had like kind of like a crash out. I don't know if they use that term in the Netherlands, but I was having like a mental episode where I really didn't want to live anymore. I wasn't going to kill myself, but I was really upset about a lot of stuff, about how things happened after the January 23rd general strike. Alex Pretty was murdered the next day. He was a union member in AFGE. And I wanted us to push and extend and expand the general strike. I was so upset about certain things. I also was doing stupid stuff like watching Alex Pretty get murdered multiple times in different angles at like 2 a.m. And like just traumatizing myself, I don't know. And then also I was traumatized because I was holding all the trauma from our members and our students and community for weeks, and I hadn't cried when people were crying all around me. And it just hit me like a ton of bricks. I know I said I'm an emotional person earlier, but sometimes when people are crying around me and I have to be strong, I don't cry. But I do sometimes. So, and I'm like getting emotional thinking about it right now. So I was like, I had to take 6 days off of work to just like deal with my stuff. And I have a chronic illness, so I ended up getting really bad chronic pain during that time. And my colleagues were like, hey, if you need to, like, get help, get help. And I had to remember, too, and the members reached out to me because some of them knew I was having a bad time. Like, we love you. We need you. We need you in the long run. But it's okay to step back. Like Rafa was saying, step up, step back. You got to know when to step up and step back. I had to step back. But I have to remember, there's 4,000 members in this union. We have like 11 staffers. We can't do everything all the time. For example, and this is my last point, the people who were doing mutual aid, delivering food to our immigrant communities who were most in need, were not patrolling and chasing ICE. They could not do that because it would put the community at harm and at risk. You can't do everything. You do what you can. And you got to remember that the fascists, they want to tire us out, but it's more important. Everyone needs in this room needs to be not just an activist, you need to be an organizer. You need to be a leader. You need to bring one more person, or two, or three, or four, or five, or 10, or 20, 50, 100 people with you into the movement. Don't do everything, because you're going to tire yourself out.